Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! As the Supreme Court takes up the issue of doctor-assisted suicide, we'll look at another form of state-sanctioned killing, a triple execution scheduled tonight in Arkansas.
There are two executioners who were involved in the execution whose identity are kept confidential. They make the injections into an already running IV saline solution that has already been placed into the arms of the condemned inmate.
We'll talk to the spiritual advisor of one of the men slated to die and a witness to an Arkansas execution this past summer.
A squad of men called the tie-down team burst into the area. These men were all dressed in body armor with helmets, boots, gloves. Two of them came in with large full-body shields. They ordered Frankie to assume the position at the back of his cell. They poured into the cell. They pinned him up against the wall and chained his hands to the waist chain.
Also, many call them political prisoners. They're Puerto Rican independence activists jailed for conspiracy for more than 15 years. Will President Clinton pardon them? All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman.
2 years ago, when I became the first Republican speaker in 40 years, to the degree I was too brash, too self-confident, or too pushy, I apologize. To whatever degree in any way that I have brought controversy or inappropriate attention to the House, I apologize.
Newt Gingrich won re-election as Speaker last night, but the narrow vote has left him weakened. 9 Republicans broke ranks in the roll call, leaving the Georgian with 216 votes, enough to win, but short of a clear majority of the 435 members. Defectors never coalesced around a rival, and only 4 backed other candidates. 5, in effect, abstained. The Speaker looked pale and drawn as he took the gavel. He said, "I felt humbled, and I feel responsible." He also talked about the military.
I've asked Chairman Spence from the National Security Committee both to look at the issue of national missile defense and to look at the question of military reform. And let me say to all of my friends on both sides of the aisle, we have every opportunity through reform to shrink the Pentagon to a triangle. We have every opportunity to apply the lessons of downsizing, the lessons of the information age, and just because something is in uniform doesn't mean it has to be saluted. But instead, we should be getting every penny for our taxpayers, and we in the Congress should be looking at long-term contracting as one way to dramatically lower the cost of defense.
The House has refused extra time for the ethics investigation of House Speaker Newt Gingrich, putting pressure on the Ethics Committee to act swiftly as the last phase of the inquiry was to begin tomorrow. When under rules adopted by the House has to vote on adopting penalties for Gingrich's admitted ethics violations by January 21st. That's a date agreed to by the committee last month, but investigators said yesterday they needed more time to ensure a fair and orderly process. This news from California. A federal appeals court says California Governor Pete Wilson should use the political process, not the courts, to collect from the U.S. government. The Ninth Circuit Court in San Francisco has rejected Wilson's suit seeking $2.4 billion for the cost of illegal immigration. Wilson claims his state has had to foot the bill for the failure of Washington to stem the flow of illegal immigrants. But the appeals court says it doesn't have the authority to decide the issue. This news from Peru, trying to seize the public relations initiative from rebels holding 74 hostages. Peru's president, Alberto Fujimori, broke his silence on the crisis and toured a prison where other Tupac Amaru rebels are being held. The Tupac Amaru rebels stormed the Japanese ambassador's residence December 17th. Fujimori has acknowledged the public relations blow suffered by his administration, which has declared victory in a vicious war against guerrillas. He said he hoped to convince journalists not to transmit the image that Peru is living in a situation of terrorism. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Tonight, for only the second time since the Supreme Court reinstituted capital punishment 20 years ago, three people will be executed at the same time. In the death house of the Cummins Unit Prison in southeastern Arkansas this morning sit 47-year-old Earl V. Denton, 49-year-old Paul Ruiz, who were both convicted of murder back in 1977, 20 years ago. Kurt Wainwright, 30 years old, is scheduled to die with them. The triple execution has sparked outrage from anti-death penalty activists. They say it's a bloodthirsty and cruel attack by politicians eager to show they're tough on crime. Governor Mike Huckabee and other state officials defend the move. We talked earlier with Dinah Tyler. She's a spokesperson with the Arkansas Department of Corrections.
The simple explanation is that the stays of execution were dissolved on all three of these inmates on the same day by the United States Supreme Court. So those dissolutions all arrived on the same day. And two of these inmates who were scheduled for execution on Wednesday night were convicted of the same murders. Also, there is another factor here, and that is that executions are very difficult on the department, both on its employees and the inmates it supervises. They are most difficult things to do. There is an emotional preparation that the staff and the inmates, too, all go through to get ready, in essence, to steal yourself for this. And by putting these executions on one night rather than three, it saves at least somewhat on the emotional toll of the employees and the inmates.
How about the expenses?
Well, sure. I mean, I think common sense will tell you that by not having three execution nights and only having one, that there would be at least a little bit of money saved. But money has never been the factor here. That is not the issue. The factor is the emotional toll and also the fact that those stays or the dissolutions all came down on the same day. Money is not the prime concern and never will be.
What accounts for the expense of, you know, killing someone? What are the costs involved?
Well, I think that there is a cost of overtime within the department. We've got people who work long hours who are called in because on an execution day you need pretty much all hands on deck. So we've got the department having to have people on extra hours. Plus, there are other agencies involved, the state police, the attorney general's office, the governor's office. Also, local law enforcement agencies around here have to supply people to us so that we can aid in the security effort. So it is a salary expense there. As far as the expense of the actual execution, that's minimal.
How are the condemned men going to die?
They are all going to die, if their executions are not stopped by the governor or the courts, by lethal injection, which is the law under which they were sentenced. Ruiz and Denton, two of the inmates scheduled for execution, were first sentenced in 1978 to die by electrocution. Well, their death sentence then was overturned, but they were retried after the law changed in 1983, so it's by lethal injection. So all three are by lethal injection.
Do you know what the chemical is that's used? We hear it's coming from a company in New Jersey.
I don't know who supplies the drugs there. It's a combination of three drugs, sodium pentothal, Pavilion, which is a muscle relaxant, and potassium chloride.
Could you just explain what the protocol is? For example, in the terms of the three chemicals that are injected into their body, does a different person flip the switch on each one?
There are two executioners who are involved in the execution whose identity are kept confidential. They make the injections into an already running IV saline solution that has already been placed into the arms of the condemned inmate.
What do you say to people like Mrs. Freddie Nixon, wife of the Reverend, I guess, who married the president and his wife, Bill and Hillary Clinton? Freddie Nixon, who heads up the state chapter of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, who said, three in one night is horrible. It looks bloodthirsty.
I say that it is, I think, easy to stand outside the department and not realize the emotional toll it takes. But once inside the department, it becomes painfully obvious how it affects everybody, how difficult it is. I speak from experience. I was a reporter in Arkansas. I covered many of the first executions once executions began in 1990. I always knew they were hard on the department, but I could not appreciate fully the emotional toll until I came to work here.
Dinah Tyler, spokesperson for the Arkansas Department of Corrections. We now turn to Pat Bain, director of Murder Victim Families for Reconciliation. She's also a spiritual advisor to Paul Ruiz, scheduled to be executed tonight. And we're speaking to her about an hour and a half south of Little Rock, where she is just outside the Cummins Unit Prison, where Paul is inside. Pat Bain, why don't you first tell us about Paul's crime?
It's a crime that happened in 1977, and like most murders, it's not a pleasant one. I don't think there's any such thing as a good murder. He and another man broke out of a prison. They didn't actually escape in the way that it sounds, but they walked away from a work detail at a prison in Oklahoma. And before the episode was over, they had killed two police officers, one a town marshal and one a park ranger, and had injured another. They were apprehended and sentenced to death. There is no justification or no condoning a crime like that. The fact is, this happened 20 years ago. The men have had three trials, and I've known Paul, the man I'm here to visit and to advise, since 1980. And have seen him over the years grow and change and become someone who is no danger and who, in fact, could live out his life in prison and I think be a contributing member of that society. He is a really different person than the man who committed a crime 20 years ago. And I just think that it's ludicrous to take people and do what it is we say we want to do to really change them and bring them to a new self and then to take their lives. We're not killing the people who committed that crime. Those people are gone. And we're killing two men who are 20 years older and who have, I believe, used their time well and have kind of educated themselves and just made new ways of life.
Tell me about your own experience with murder, being the head of this Murder Victims Families Reconciliation Group.
I think that's a very important component here for me because I have a real concern for these victims' family members in this case. Back in the late 50s, my dad's brother was murdered, and he and my father were very close. He had four children, and he left a wife, and the cousins were about the ages of my sister and I, and so we were close to that family. And I watched my aunt having to change her life and raise her kids without her husband, and I saw my father's anger and turmoil, as well as the rest of his brothers and sisters, when they lost their brother to a very senseless crime. He was mugged and left brain damaged on the street after a severe beating, and died as a result of that beating. So I know what a family goes through when a crazy crime like that happens. I think I was very fortunate, and I realize more and more as the years go on that I was lucky to grow up in a family that never supported the death penalty. And despite our anger and confusion and pain over that incident, somehow we never translated that into support for the death penalty. First of all, the crime is still unsolved. There was an arrest, and for a while it looked like there would be a trial, but it turned out that there was insufficient evidence and the man was released. Now, there was a lot of anger around that, too, but we never had to deal with a trial. But nonetheless, until he died in his 80s, I never heard my father support a death penalty. And I really didn't appreciate it so much then as I do now. I think that what happens to a family when a loved one is violently taken from them is that they have two things to deal with. They have to deal with a crime, and they have to deal with a loss. And unfortunately, when we seek a death penalty, we put great emphasis on the crime, very often casting aside the loss and the grieving and the things that you do when you lose somebody you love. And those things don't get taken care of. These families, in their pain, were offered death sentences for the men who committed this crime. And when you're at the lowest point in your life, you're just reaching out for other people to give you something to make you feel better, and you take what you're given. And we put this expectation on victims that they want the very worst thing that can be done, and we offer them more bodies, and they accept that. Once they accept it, they begin to equate it with justice. If these two men had been sentenced to life in prison, and they had begun serving that sentence, justice would already be being achieved. They'd be serving their sentence. When they're sentenced to death, you wait for them to die for justice to be done. And they've been waiting 20 years. And all this time, they've been focused on these men. And probably, from the things I've been reading in the paper and hearing that they say, probably are still very, very angry at them. When these men are killed, the focus of the past 20 years for these families is going to be gone. And I hope they have something to take its place. I hope that they can really find closure, and I hope that they have grieved and dealt with their loss as well, because many families do not. And the people come to us and say that the execution opened everything up for them again, and they were right back where they were when the murder happened.
Pat Vane, what has it been like to be in the death house with Paul Ruiz?
Grim. Although it's not because of Paul that it's been grim. He's handling it very well. He is very accepting, and I don't think even afraid to die. And has been as much a support to me as I hope I have been to him. But it actually, to me, has felt like I am living in some alien place or in a place where everybody's crazy and you begin to doubt your own sanity. And these people are no doubt good people, and I think they try their very best to make things as easy as they can. But to sit down and see in black and white the preparations being made to take three lives just is beyond my comprehension. And to sit down and talk, we were visiting one day, this is just an example, when someone came to the door and said, could you come down to so-and-so's office? We need to know what you want done with your body. Now, to just holler something like this in the door to somebody really, really startled and upset me more than it did Paul, because he's been living with this. He's been living on death row where this is said to men over and over. I think that he has the advantage of experience, and nothing is a surprise. These are all surprises to me. I've never been in the death house before, although I've done this work for many years. I have never actually been this close, and it's a very bizarre place to be.
Does President Clinton, being the former governor of Arkansas, fit in here at all?
Well, President Clinton executed several people while he was governor. So I don't think that he would be apt to be any influence against an execution. President Clinton, if you'll remember, interrupted his campaign, his first campaign for the presidency twice to come back to Arkansas and sign two death warrants, one for Ricky Lee Rector, a man who had been shot in the head and had had a bullet in his brain and was, according to all accounts, little more than a vegetable and didn't even know where he was going when he was taken to the execution chamber. And the other, a young man named Stephen Hill, who was kind of borderline mentally retarded, had escaped from prison after having been raped in prison and holed up in a farmhouse with another young man who'd escaped with him. And when the police came in to take them, they shot one of them. At first, they said that Stephen committed the killing, and he was sentenced to death. After that death sentence, the other young man admitted that, in fact, he had committed committed the killing and had talked Stephen into confessing, believing that no jury would ever sentence him to death. Governor Clinton refused to stop that execution. So I'm not sure that he would be very helpful in this.
Any final words as you go off today to be with Paul Ruiz one last time?
Well, I think that we will be preparing for the worst. We'll be hoping for the best. And I would urge people across this country who don't think that sending the message that it's okay to kill people, as the state of Arkansas is doing, is the right message to send. I think that we need to say we won't tolerate killing, and we need to practice that by not performing executions. So I just urge people to call Governor Huckabee and to express their feelings about this triple execution, particularly as we come out of the Christmas season where we have just celebrated our goodwill and our love for one another.
And the number we have for Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee is 501-682-2345. That's 501-682-2345. Pat Bain, thanks very much for being with us. Pat is the director of Murder Victim Families for Reconciliation based in Virginia, but she's in Arkansas right now. She's the spiritual advisor to Paul Ruiz, scheduled to be executed tonight. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll talk to a witness of an Arkansas execution this past summer. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Reverend Kobutsu Kevin Malone is a Zen priest and a spiritual advisor to Frankie Parker, formerly an Arkansas death row inmate who was executed this past August. Reverend Kobutsu is leading a protest tonight outside the headquarters of the Organon Company in West Orange, New Jersey. Organon manufactures the muscle relaxant Pavulon, one of the three drugs that make up the deadly cocktail that will be injected into the prisoners tonight, unless there is a last-minute stay. Kobutsu, rarely do people get a chance to find out what happens in the last minutes and hours before a prisoner is executed. Can you describe what happened in August when you were advising Frankie Parker?
One of the deputy directors of the Department of Corrections informed me that it was almost time. We had been sitting in a very tiny cell, over 95 degree heat all day long, so it was extremely hot. There was no ventilation or air conditioning. And we, at that point, I prepared by putting on my robe and my vestments. Shortly thereafter, a squad of men called the tie-down team burst into the area. These men were all dressed in body armor with helmets, boots, gloves. Two of them came in with large full-body shields. They ordered Frankie to assume the position at the back of his cell. They poured into the cell. They pinned him up against the wall. The two shielded carrying men pinned him against the wall while other men chained his ankles, put chains around his waist, and chained his hands to the waist chain. At which point they moved him out of the cell into the corridor, And I was guided. I was chanting at the time. He and I had agreed to chant the three refuges, the Buddhist chant. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. And we did this over and over again. It was a very short walk to the hallway that constitutes the last mile, and this hallway itself is only about 15 or 18 feet long, and the hallway was lined with more men dressed in riot gear. Each side of the hallway, you know, they were shoulder to shoulder pretty much. We got to the center of the hallway, and by prior arrangement, there was a small cardboard box with a Buddha figure on it. And we approached the Buddha figure. We turned to it. We bowed once to the Buddha. We turned and faced each other. And we bowed three times, once for the Buddha, once for the Dharma, once for the Sangha. And at that point, we stopped our chant, and I looked at him directly in the face, and I saw a single tear came from his right eye and rolled down his cheek. We embraced as best we were able. He was chained, and as we embraced, he whispered in my ear, "I love you, my brother. Thank you so much." And at that point, I backed away. We bowed one more time to each other. Our foreheads touched as we bowed. And at that point, the men guided me out the outer side door by my elbows, and Frankie was taken into the execution chamber. As soon as I stepped out of the building, the hearse that we'd arranged to take his body was sitting there waiting. I continued chanting, and I was directed around the perimeter of the building to another entrance, where I was told to wait, and I continued my chanting. Directly behind me was a white van that had the witnesses in it. They had it there with the air conditioner on and then the engine running. And we waited for a few minutes until they had tied Frankie down to the gurney in the death chamber. This is done. The witnesses are kept out of the building in case there's trouble. They don't want to upset the witnesses by having them listen to a man scream for his life as they're tying him down to be poisoned. The door opened, and one of the officers indicated that I should enter, and I entered and went to the front of the room and stood next to the large picture window that was at the front of the room. The room was it was the coolest I'd been all day. All the room itself was completely air conditioned, and the seats were, you know, all plush. Plushly upholstered. It was a very nice room, certainly quite a bit different from where I'd spent the earlier part of the day in over 95 degree heat. The witnesses came in. They were seated. A few minutes later, there was a screen behind the window, which was opened. And the witness chamber, the witness room, the viewing room was immediately filled with an intense white light And we were able to see into the actual death chamber. And Frankie was strapped to a gurney. His hands, his arms were strapped to two boards that came out diagonally from the gurney. There were two intravenous bags on stands behind him, and intravenous lines going into his arms. Directly behind him stood Mr. Larry Norris, who is the director of the Department of Corrections for the state of Arkansas. And behind him on the wall was a large digital clock with red numerals indicating the time. I had promised Frankie that I would continue chanting earlier, and I continued chanting out loud during the entire procedure. They made an announcement which couldn't really be heard. The public address system was not very loud, and I think my chanting was probably contributed to the fact that we weren't able to hear exactly what was said in there. Frankie had was covered with a white sheet, and we had he had been ordained as a Buddhist monk earlier. I ordained him 4 days before he was killed, before he was put to death. And we had arranged with the Department of Corrections that he be allowed to wear his roksu, which is a bib-like vestment. And it's essentially an abbreviated form of the Buddha's robe. So he was allowed to wear that. There was a small, Frankie had paper-clipped a small picture of His Holiness the Dalai Lama on one of the straps of his vestment, and you could see His Holiness's head sort of peeking out from under the sheet. He made me promise that I would present that picture to His Holiness the Dalai Lama the first opportunity I got. His head was strapped between two plates, and there was a strap over his forehead. It was difficult to see any of the other restraints because they were all covered with a sheet. A few minutes went by, approximately 4 minutes went by, and another announcement was made, and then a man came in with a stethoscope and examined Frankie. I knew at that point, because I knew the procedure, I knew that he had been wired to electronic monitors, and that the electronic monitors had indicated that he was dead, and they were bringing in the coroner to make the official pronouncement of death. And the curtains closed, and the witnesses were all ushered out of the room. I continued my chanting and my prostrations. And finally, a man, two guards came over and essentially took me by the elbows and said, you must go now, Reverend. The following morning, I went to a local radio station down there, spoke for approximately an hour, told of my experiences the night before. During that time, people came to the door of the radio station, pounding on it, trying to get at me. The lady who answered the telephone quit for the day because she couldn't take the abuse the abusive telephone calls they were receiving. I finally finished at the radio station, and I went back to the prison where the death row is, and I was allowed by a very gracious warden. I was allowed to walk death row, and I went to each cell, and I shook hands with each man, told them exactly what I had experienced, told them how Frankie had died, told them that he had died as a man. I told them that he had died in an extremely dignified manner. Many of them wept. They thanked me because I was the only spiritual advisor who had come to them and told them the truth after the execution.
Were some of those men the men who will die tonight?
Those men will die tonight, yes. Unless there are reprieves. One of them had been in tears when I met him.
Reverend Kobutsu, Kevin Malone, I want to thank you very much for recounting that story. I know it's tough. Kobutsu is a Zen priest, and if you'd like to get a written account of his story as well as find out about the work that his group is doing, the Engage Zen Foundation, you can write to the Engage Zen Foundation, P.O. Box 700, Ramsey, New Jersey, 07446. That's Engage Zen Foundation, P.O. Box 700, Ramsey, New Jersey, 07446. Again, Reverend Kobutsu Kevin Malone, spiritual advisor to Frankie Parker. He had murdered his in-laws and was executed by the state of Arkansas this past August. You're listening to Democracy Now! If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230.
Precious alive, do we see you? Do we see what we've undone in the way we view ourselves? And abuse our mother's love. Precious life, do we see you? You're everything and everyone. Precious life, do we see you? Do we know that you our love?
Tony Bird singing Precious Life from our studios at WBAI in New York. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Right now, we turn to a different kind of prison story. Pressure is mounting on President Clinton to grant clemency to 15 Puerto Rican nationalists who've been in federal prison since the early 1980s on seditious conspiracy and weapons charges. And my co-host Juan Gonzalez, a columnist for the New York Daily News, wrote a piece on this story yesterday. We're going to go to Juan in a minute, and then to one of those prisoners who's been in jail for 17 years, Elizam Escobar. Will also be joined by the mother of two of the prisoners, as well as Congressmember Nydia Velazquez from New York. Juan?
Yes, Amy. Good morning. The 15 political prisoners, Puerto Rican political prisoners, have been in jail, many of them, since 1980. Some of them were alleged to be members of the FALN, which is a group that throughout the late 1970s and early 1980s engaged in attacks on American institutions in an attempt to win independence for Puerto Rico. And a few of them were alleged to be members of the Macheteros, another group based in the island in Puerto Rico that whose most spectacular action was the 1982 Wells Fargo robbery of $7 million. So that the 15 prisoners now, many of them were sentenced to, they were sentenced to an average of 70 years in jail each, although most of the ones who are in jail were convicted in Chicago, not directly of any bombings or of any injuries to people, but on seditious conspiracy charges, attempting to overthrow the U.S. government's control of Puerto Rico. So we have with us Congresswoman Nydia Velazquez, as well as, I understand, one of the one of the prisoners, Elisam Escobar. I would like to first ask Congressman Velasquez.
Juan, before we go to Congressmember Velasquez, we just have to break, and then we'll go to all of our guests from Washington to Oklahoma and out to Chicago. You're listening to Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in 60 seconds. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. And Juan, we have Elisam Escobar on the phone, the Puerto Rican prisoner for 17 years, presently a prisoner in FCI El Reno in Oklahoma.
Yes, good morning, Elisam. And welcome to Democracy Now!
How you doing?
Can you tell us a little bit about what your sense is in terms of the possibility for what you've heard of the possibility of finally being able to get out of jail?
Well, but I think that the campaign for our incarceration has been very effective, and it has rallied around, the fact that we have been given so long sentences.
Elisam, can you speak as loudly as you can?
Okay. So as I understand, in Puerto Rico, for example, all the ideological political tendencies in Puerto Rico agree that we should be incarcerated. And they have different opinions and different arguments to support that. But basically, I think that beyond or regardless of the different consensus that exists in Puerto Rico around our situation, that we live the last years of this century, which is supposed to be the last decade of colonialism. And I think that the United States has a responsibility to show that they have good faith in resolving our century all under U.S. domination colonial problem. And so this is not going to go away. And so I think that now is the time to show that good faith.
Elisam, what have been the conditions that you've had to confront the past few years in prison? Do you feel you've been singled out, or you and the other prisoners have been singled out for especially harsh treatment?
Well, I think that, you know, from the beginning we have being singled out. I mean, in a very ironic way, sometimes we are saying that, you know, we are like everybody else, and other times they show that, you know, the security is very different for us. So in individual cases, I think that some people have been under real harsh situations, like Oscar Lopez, who is being, you know, right now he's in Marion after being in Florence. And after being able to comply with all the requirements for the program to go to another prison. So I think that the hardest condition that we have been, that we have lived through all these almost 17 years in prison is that we are basically isolated from the Puerto Rican community, that we live, I mean, like I am in Oklahoma, which is very far away from any city where my family can come and visit me. And I think that culturally, this is another way of submitting us to a double way of being, you know, in a colonial situation. And so I have been betrayed from my culture. And
you have a son in New York, don't you?
I have a son in New York City.
How often have you had a chance to see him?
Well, right now, because of the help of friends and family, I'm able to see him once a year, sometimes two times a year, but it's really big sacrifices, you know, in order to come here.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Juan.
Yeah, I'd like to bring in Congresswoman Nydia Velazquez, who has been leading the fight with the Puerto Rican Congress members to attempt to get a presidential pardon or clemency for the 15 prisoners. Congresswoman Velazquez, a couple of weeks ago, you met with Jack Quinn, the special counsel to the president. Could you tell us about that meeting and what is your sense of where the administration might be going?
Well, good morning, Juan, and thank you for allowing me to participate in this program. The meeting, I found it very constructive. The decision of meeting right after the November election, we knew that nothing will happen prior to that, to the presidential election. And also taking into account the fact of the visibility of Latinos in this country, politically speaking, and Puerto Ricans particularly, we made an effort to reach out to the White House and Jack Quinn and to express to him the desire of the Puerto Rican family here and in Puerto Rico to get their sons and daughters released from prison. We explained to Jack Quinn that we understand that this is a political decision that the president has to make, that the call for their release enjoys wide support here and in Puerto Rico and internationally. He was listening very cautiously and very carefully. I found him very receptive. And he understands now that even though some people in Puerto Rico do not support this, such as the present delegate, Carlos Romero Barceló, who sits on the House of Representatives, that even the current governor, Pedro Rosselló, that he has stated his belief that these prisoners have already served a reasonable time in prison. We explained to Jack Quinn that these people who are in prison today, they are serving extraordinarily lengthy sentences, which are disproportionate when compared to sentences that for all other offenses. So that we understand that these are political prisoners, that they should support their release, and that they should not be afraid of political consequences in Puerto Rico. So the main argument for them is to, and I also explained to them, as an insider, as a person who worked for the government of Puerto Rico, I was able to try to explain to them that they should not fear that some sectors in Puerto Rico will not support this, that this is a very important issue, that is an emotional issue, that really brings together most of the people in Puerto Rico, even the most conservative forces in Puerto Rico and the Puerto Rican community in the island. He explained to us that it was important that we get a meeting with the Attorney General, and that she made a recommendation to the president. But this is not necessarily so to get the president to act on this request.
Well, one thing that we should note, back in 1979, President Jimmy Carter freed four nationalists from jail after 25 years. And at that time, the Attorney General recommended against the pardon. But recently declassified memos from the Brzezinski, who was the head of the National Security Council at that time, shows that that the recommendation from Mr. Brzezinski to Carter was to free them for political and international reasons, among which were that the United States would be seen in a better light in terms of its humanitarian and human rights policy around the world, and also because at the time there was actually a secret prisoner exchange where Cuba released six prisoners, American citizens that were in Cuban jails. So that it, as that would seem to back up what you're saying, yeah. Congresswoman Velasquez,
also,
that it is political.
We tried to explain to Jack Quinn that this is a great opportunity for the president. It's ironic that the Clinton administration welcomes Nelson Mandela and Arafat and all these leaders who have been freedom fighters, and yet we denied the release of these people for the same goals that Mandela and Arafat and all these political leaders today have been fighting, and they fought all their lives. So if their love to the country was an act of love for their people, for the independence of Puerto Rico, and that's a reality that we must face. You know, we haven't resolved the political situation in Puerto Rico. These people are not criminals. They didn't commit any crime, and they paid a long fine. They have been in jail for too long.
Yes, I'd like to bring in Josefina Rodriguez from Chicago, who's the mother of two of the prisoners, Alicia and Ida Luz Rodriguez. How has it been for you these past 17 years? And could you tell us about how the community in Chicago has responded to the issue of the prisoners?
Well, first of all, good morning, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to be on this program. To be honest with you, it has been very hard for not only for me, the mother, but the whole family. My daughters were arrested in 1980, and even though they were arrested together, they were tried and sentenced at the state level, and one of them, Alicia, was sentenced to 30 years at the state level, plus 1 year contempt, and Ida Luz was sentenced to 8 years. That means that they were together for 4 years, and after 4 years, they transfer Ida Luz to the federal prison in New York, and Alicia stayed in Dwight Correctional Center here in Chicago. That meant that they were separated, and was very hard for us since we were able to see them every week together at Dwight. And Lucy was in New York for about 11 months at the MCC. And from there, she was moved to Alderson, West Virginia, for another probably 10, 11 more months. And from there, she was transferred to San Diego, and from San Diego to Pleasanton, Dublin, and California. And Alicia was still in Dwight. Alicia was there for 16 years. She was just moved about 7 months ago. And Dwight Correctional Center is well known as a very bad a state prison for women. And she went through a whole lot of discrimination and faced a lot of problems. And that reflected all of us in the family. For 16 years she was there, she had to have a guard. Anytime she was moved from one unit to another, she had to have a guard. She was there for 16 years. She was a model prisoner. From now, she is in Pleasanton with her daughter, with my other daughter, Lucy, and the other compañeras, Carmen Valentin and Dilcia Pagan. So you can imagine how hard it is for me as a mother. My husband is a pretty sick man. He had two heart operations, open heart surgery. He's suffering now from ataxia cerebellosa, which is a problem that he hardly can walk. So for us to visit in California, we were able to visit once a year and sometimes close to 2 years. It's very hard. But in the question of how the community have responded to the issue of the prisoners, these prisoners from Chicago were born, most of them, and raised in Chicago in our same community that we live in. And they were well known, they're well respected, because they were pretty much involved in issues that affected our community and in every area. So they were respected. They were loved. Nowadays, it was hard for the community people to accept their position of prisoners of war at the beginning. It was that we had to talk to people and try to make, you know, keep, make them understand that position. It was hard. But nowadays, every time we go to our community, we face with the same response. They are not terrorists. They are prisoners of war. They are patriots. They are our community people. They were very well known. They were well respected. And we think that we need these people back in our communities.
Well,
for
I'd
our
like
families.
To ask, Josefina and also Elisam, if you're still on, how do you feel in terms of the fact, for instance, in the year that you were sentenced, the average federal inmate who was sentenced for murder only got 10 years in jail. The average federal inmate who was sentenced for kidnapping got 21 years in jail. And you all ended up getting an average of 70 years in jail. What do you feel is behind that disproportionately high sentence that all of the 15 received?
What I think basically is to make up an example for those who dare to fight colonialism. And I think that is something that it hasn't worked and it won't work because we have thousands of political prisoners in the U.S. Control of Puerto Rico, and I fear that if, like I say, you know, it's not a good faith sign of the United States, I fear that the new generation may be even more radical than we have been. I think that, well, I heard that there's some students right now in a hunger strike in San Juan, supporting our incarceration. And I hope that this is not something that will end in something negative, that put their life in risk. And I myself will make a call for them not to do it. But we are really not in control of this. So I think it's important to understand that the sentence that they have imposed on us is based on the fear of the United States colonial system to take a decision that is based on the highest concept of international law and the United Nations, including the U.S. Constitution. If we are frank and if we are honest, I think this is the time to try to take a decision and to avoid a worse situation that will raise from the perpetuation of a colonial system in Puerto Rico.
Elisam Escobar, we do have to wrap up the show, and I want to thank you very much for joining us. I know it was difficult for you as you speak to us from the FCI El Reno prison in Oklahoma. Juan, as we wrap up, could you let listeners know about what's happening Saturday here in Washington, D.C., which is really quite unusual?
Yes, there's going to be a service Saturday at All Souls Church in Washington, D.C. It's an ecumenical service by a variety of leaders of major religious groups from both Puerto Rico and the United States.
President Clinton's
church. To increase the pressure on President Clinton to consider an amnesty, and that will be happening this Saturday. For those who are interested in more information, they can get it by calling area code 718-601-4751. That's area code 718-601-4751.
And again, the All Souls Church is the church that President Clinton and Hillary Clinton go to on Sundays. Well, Juan, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Congressmember Nidia Velasquez, thank you for joining us. And Josefina Rodriguez joining us from Chicago, the mother of two of the 15 Puerto Rican prisoners who are serving more than 70 years in prison. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin and Errol Maitland. Errol engineered from New York. Julie Drizin engineered from Washington. Julie Drizin is also our executive producer. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for being with us for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!